If I can invite the other speakers, if they're here, and to the podium. While we're waiting for this, I'm just going to ask a quick question to Dr. Warner and then go back to our depression and neurocognitive function issues. So you showed us very intriguing data, Christoph. What are we supposed to expect next in terms of clinical trials? And, you know, this was a secondary outcome, and obviously we would expect to do expect studies from the same company or with other drugs, similar drugs. What's the next step here?
The company Boehringer with empagliflozin is currently thinking to do a renal outcome trial, including non-diabetic chronic kidney disease, because proteinuric patients with non-diabetic kidney disease are hyperfiltering. And if the hypothesis is correct in the data, then they should also have benefit. So including non-diabetics with chronic kidney disease. And in parallel, AstraZeneca has announced the same trial. So we will get more data in this field. And third, Janssen with canagliflozin is running a trial in advanced diabetic kidney disease, the CREDENCE trial, and this will give us data in 2019. So a number of CKD and DKT trials are running and designed, and this will be exciting.
Okay.
Can I ask just one question, Dr. Warner? How can you be sure in terms of the cardiovascular benefit that most of it is not due to improved volume control by the diuretic effect of the drugs?
Because you saw this nice signal in heart failure. And how I'm sure that... Tell me again that...
That most of the benefit is not related to the volume control issue.
To the volume
the drugs,
control.
Yeah.
Actually... The other hypothesis with ketone bodies and failing heart are not so prominent that the volume control. So more oxygen supply because of the higher hematocrit, less sympathetic nerve activity because heart rate is stable under the osmotic diuresis, less cardiovascular stretch. These are several additional hypotheses which may be true, but you may also have the best argument in hand.
Okay.
I think nobody knows.
No one knows, yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Yeah, a couple of other questions about the EMPA-REC trial for Dr. Warner. The first one is, are there any data on left ventricular hypertrophy changes with EMPA trial with the drug? Or any effect on 24-hour blood pressure control? Did you collect any data for blood pressure as well as LVH in that study?
The 24-hour blood pressure trials are smaller, with 200 patients in the trial. The outcome trials are not suitable, or they could include a subgroup, but we haven't done this. So the data in the 24-hour blood pressure in other type 2 diabetics more or less show the similar curves than we have seen here. So okay. It's quite consistent with 5 millimeter mercury decrease in blood pressure over the entire period.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'm just going to continue 2 or 3 more with the EMPA trial, if you guys don't mind. I think this is answered. Are there any studies to use the EMPA in non-diabetic patients to preserve renal function? And in addition to that, are there any trials that are looking at weight loss as the primary outcome for this drug for people who don't have any problems other than obesity, like pre-diabetics who have obesity? Are you aware of any of those studies or any approach?
Yeah. These data are currently presented at congresses. The EMPA-REC outcome trial was a surprise, and then the mechanistic and all these studies have been done. Meanwhile, we see that about 50% of weight loss is fat mass, abdominal fat mass, and 50% is volume contraction. And these have been done in metabolic studies. And this happens during the first 6 months. And then overeating starts.
Oh, overeating, okay.
So no more, because you lose 300 calories every day. You should vanish over time. But this does not happen. So compensatory mechanisms are in place and people start to eat more.
Okay, that's a good point. So two more quick questions. One is, you commented about the ACE inhibition and its possible interaction. Is it an additive or a negative effect in terms of proteinuria? And then one technical question, what did you show a stepwise increase in the Kaplan-Meier curves every 3-6 months? And I'm assuming that's blood. That's when the biomarkers were measured. This Kaplan-Meier were a stepwise increase over 3-6 months when you look at the figure.
Acoustics here are very bad. So, I hope I got it.
So the first question is, what is the interaction with ACE inhibitors in terms of proteinuria? Yeah.
So 80% of the population was on ACE inhibition, and in addition to ACE, to RAS blockade, there is this 50% decrease in albuminuria. And in the 20% of patients which were not on ARBs, the same reduction occurs. So the effect on albuminuria is the same in both groups.
Okay. And then there's one other last question for the EMPA-REG, I assume.
Oh, this is for the depression talk.
Okay, we can switch to depression talk.
Oh,
I think that's a good start for the depression talk.
Okay, thanks for Dr. Finkelstein and Enru. We know in HIV and hepatitis C patients that neurocognitive impairment can sometimes be a problem. Do you know the prevalence and concomitant CKD in those two different populations?
So I don't have that offhand. I think that's a valid point, that we're looking at a population that has multiple comorbidities in addition to advanced age. And so you'd expect those other comorbidities to influence the rate. There is a higher rate of cognitive impairment among diabetics who also have ESRD compared to just ESRD alone or diabetes alone. Do you want me to read it for you, Al?
It's my age. I'm sorry. Or it's maybe the hunger before lunch. I don't know. It's either one of them. But the next question is, how good are the data regarding intradialytic hypotension on cognitive impairment?
Dr. McIntyre, who's speaking here, can answer that too. With much greater verve and vigor than I can. But I can tell you in the small descriptive studies that he's done, he's able to demonstrate an impact in intradialytic hypotension on cerebral perfusion, and he's also done a small number of neurocognitive tests in those patients and demonstrated an impact in their performance. These studies generally have about 25 people pre and post, so they're hypothesis generating and really interesting observations. It's not, gospel, I would say, but they are very interesting findings.
Okay. Next question is for Dr. Finkelstein. Actually, something I was thinking as well. The question is, I have found that the major barrier is a timely referral to a trained professional. Are there any plans in the integrated care with mental health professionals in hemodialysis units, or how are we going to be able to do what you've talked about with the staffing problem we have in the dialysis unit?
Yeah, so I think that's the challenge we have going forward. We are screening for depression. There are going to be more patient-reported outcome measures included into routine care. The challenge is what you do with that information and how you deal with it. So I can give you several scenarios. I was recently doing some teaching in Cartagena, for example, Colombia. They have a psychologist on staff in their hemodialysis units to help them deal with depression, anxiety assessments. You can train nurses. You can train technicians in the unit to provide care. You can look at this computerized adaptive testing, for example. You could partner with some psychiatric folks and try to use computers to help provide assistance to patients. I think we need to be innovative. We need to think how we're going to deal with these issues going forward. I mean, Mark's saying we're going to screen for cognitive difficulties. What do you do with the information when you get that back? You're going to screen for physical disabilities. People are going to have functional impairments. What do you do with that? How are we going to manage those patients? We need to take a step back now and think out of the box how we're going to deal with this.
So a follow-up question to what you said. Is a CAT, the CAT, available currently to be used in the dialysis units?
No, it's not. But if you go through the literature on that, it's used in the psychiatric world very much so now, and giving feedback, and the literature on that is sort of very promising. Yeah. I think that's something someone needs to look at that in the ESRD field now.
Yeah. I think we've discussed that most dialysis patients do have a phone that they can actually use. I think the smartphones are very commonly used in the dialysis units, and that's where the new innovations are really.
Again, if you look at the literature, look at Bash's paper, which is interesting to me. It's a large series in people in oncology clinics, and almost everyone's filling these things out. And the important thing is that the patients realize that a benefit's occurring. So if you simply fill out the questionnaire and you get no feedback on it, what's the point? But if you do realize that these issues are being addressed, that's the piece that's interesting. Let me make one last comment. The other advantage computerized adaptive testing has, again, in the Bash paper, that you can send out alerts to clinicians, nurses, physicians, whatever, that something has changed. The depression score has gone up, pain scores have gone up, and that's what translates into the benefit of management.
So the next two questions are both for both of you, Mark and Fred, and I think they're interrelated, and the question is, how do you establish a baseline for these assessments? I mean, where they start? Like, do you do this when the patient first comes to the dialysis unit, and then when you follow them over time, and do them repetitively, especially monthly, there will be changes, obviously, up and down. How do you say that somebody is below a threshold, or do you always look at the baseline where they started? Because there may be a variability in terms of what you get when you start, and it may be dependent on the first 3 months or 4 months of dialysis, and things might be totally different at that time. How do you really correlate that, and are there any studies that have been published in terms of this longitudinal assessment?
Okay,
So I guess I respectfully disagree with Fred in that I think that the frequency of doing these assessments is very much up in the air. You know, while you can look at the results of the SMILE study and see that the results are variable month to month, you could also say that maybe assessing month to month is too frequent because you'll get a lot of noise, right? So I think that, you know, it's an area that remains to be studied. And that, you know, I think that the challenge will be, however frequently we end up assessing, doing something with the results. Setting a baseline will likely be sort of set or established for us by regulatory forces. You know, they'll probably, I don't have the final decision from CMS in hand, but it's likely that we'll have to do it within the first 3 months. And that will be the baseline cognitive and physical functioning status for that patient that will be expected to maintain. But that hasn't been written into law yet.
So let me get a slightly different answer. I mean, Mark, but you'd agree that once a year is not nearly sufficient, right? Doesn't make any sense.
We could have a debate next year.
We could have a debate next year on that. Okay. So I think, again, I'm looking at lessons from the psychiatric literature, from the oncology literature, from the neurology literature, where these computerized things are given out in a much more frequent pace, either monthly or quarterly, and patients don't seem to mind. That's what that literature sort of suggests. Yeah. You know, just one little comment on the baseline. You know, I think there are two issues that need to be looked at. For each patient has to be seen as an individual, and I think on the one hand, you want to look for changes in those scores over time and then understand what's responsible for those changes. We looked at that in the PDOPS now, which is a peritoneal arm of DOPS, and we had health-related quality of life measures over time and looked at morbidity and mortality. And it looked as though what was most important was what the absolute score was and not so much the change in predicting the outcome in the subsequent six-month period of time. On the other hand, from an individual patient's point of view, changes what you see can be really critically important.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have very quick questions. One is, what is your thoughts on a regular assessment of hope? With a tool like Beck, hopelessness scale, is hope a good question to ask, or hopelessness to these patients?
I mean, I can answer that. I think, it's part of it. Again, you have to think, let me go back. What the definitive instrument that should be used to look at assess patients' health-related quality of life is certainly not clear. What is clear to me is that using standardized instruments like the KDQOL-36, which is given now, is really not very helpful and not particularly useful. And again, I think we need to think outside the box, come up with, and let me backtrack, and rather than have CMS mandate for us what we should do, what I'd like to see CMS mandate is that you look at health-related quality of life using patient-reported outcome measures, but not define what those measures are, and that people play with measures and then come back and watch what happens over the subsequent 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then decide what measures seem to be optimal. The question that I like best for individuals, and I think this came out very clearly in the session with patients yesterday, is what is important for that individual patient is what's most important. And that's the thing I think you need to think about. So you can document for you that sexual function occurs at a very reduced level in patients, but if you ask patients, is that of concern for them, the answer is no, for most of them at least. Yeah.
I think the concept of precision medicine is absolutely applicable to this area as well. And you need to be as precise as possible to be able to provide. That said, another question is, what is the most, or what's the drug of choice or intervention of choice in terms of your priorities with a patient who has diagnosed with depression in the setting of outpatient dialysis? I mean, where would you start with? And if you were to start with the intervention, if you need to go to a pharmacological therapy, what would be the drug of choice for practical reasons?
So I guess I'll take a shot at this. I would first establish an important note. The study that Dr. Finkelstein cited in AJKD, looking at the effect of sertraline, it was the results were from a total of 37 people, not 3,700 or 6,600 like the SGLT2 studies, right? And so it was a study that was very, very underpowered. And so the observation that there wasn't a significant difference between, sertraline and placebo wasn't surprising because you wouldn't expect to see one. And I tell you that because, when you review the literature, sertraline probably is the drug that has the highest number of published studies behind it. It's the drug that we chose to use in ASCEND. In addition to, choosing the drug, you need to choose the right dose. And it's probably something that you need to monitor. So, just starting patients on 50 milligrams of sertraline probably isn't good enough, right? I agree with start low and go slow, but you need to titrate it up if the patient remains depressed. So that, a patient who over the course of weeks is on 50 but is depressed, you need to titrate it up to 100 or 150 to 200 stepwise. At that point, you can reassess. For those of you that have access to good sort of psychosocial interventionalists, cognitive behavioral therapy actually has two smallish randomized trials in dialysis, and I think that would be a very reasonable option. I can tell you there are a number of challenges to using CBT in that you can't have another provider come into your unit unless it's part of a clinical trial. So, having bed or chair-side CBT probably is unlikely for most people in practice. On the other hand, if you can arrange it so that there is a provider of CBT who's willing to see your patients in an office, I think that'd be a terrific option with some data supporting it.
Excellent. Dr. Warner?
Depression is very frequent in heart failure patients as well, and mechanism appears similar. A recent trial in JAMA with sertraline in 600 heart failure patients did not show any benefit. Yeah. So this was surprising for me, and I don't know whether we can extrapolate some of the findings to our patients.
Sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. So I have one more question, and I don't know how. That's a very challenging question. I'd like to hear what the experts would say. You started with this, Mark, and you said you can diagnose someone with dementia. And if you diagnose someone with dementia at the dialysis unit, what would you do with them? That's the question I got. Tough question.
Do I get that one? Or? So I guess if you'll note, I left off the treatment of dementia from my talk because I was focused on screening, and I think that the treatment of cognitive impairment and dementia is rather difficult. I would say something that I take to heart is that physical activity itself has been shown to be associated with a reduced likelihood of developing dementia and cognitive impairment. So the extent to which we can activate our patients and get them moving, either with CKD or ESRD, I think it's a good thing and likely protective. I will tell you that the risk-benefit ratio of the current dementia medications isn't great, and that, you know, when reviewing them, it wouldn't be something I would necessarily start in my patients. If a patient is started on that by another clinician, I would just make sure that they understood the sort of risk-benefit profile for the individual medication they were given and make sure that it was dosed appropriately for ESRD or used in patients with ESRD or CKD appropriately. But currently, there isn't a lot to do to slow the rate of progression of cognitive impairment, particularly among patients with ESRD. I would say it's something to keep in mind when you're trying to manage patients and trying to get them the support they need to deal with a complex medical regimen.
Anything else to add? Christoph, Fred?
No? Christoph, we'll take your help on that one.
Anyway, I think I believe I covered all the questions. If there's anyone who had a note that I did not cover, please raise your hand. I'll be more than happy to redirect the question. Go ahead.
So, Christoph, I guess it's hard for me to express how exciting these findings are to me and how promising they are to me as a nephrologist who takes care of a ton of patients with diabetic kidney disease. I wonder, at what point will the FDA allow us to go down to 30? And then I wonder, kind of given the proliferation of these meds, at what point we'll see a bending of the ESRD curve in diabetes on a population level? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have some information from the company they discussed with the FDA and EMA, and due to the secondary nature, where the endpoints are not adjudicated and some of the data are not sustained, the second measurement, they want to see a second trial. And therefore, we have to wait to get a claim until 2019, okay. And this is pretty clear. So I'm playing around some tricks and go back to urine collection, put together creatinine clearance and urea clearance, and I get a totally different number than the estimated GFR, and the patient is in label with these tricks. And so what should I do? And actually, in Germany, the drug is 1.19 €, and if I go off label, nobody cares. So, okay, 2019.
Okay.
And how long do we have to wait? We see in many developed countries a decline in type 2 diabetics incident on dialysis. USRDS is showing this, a number of countries in Europe. And maybe it is not the RAS blockade and the blood pressure, but usually 10 years later, you will see this.
Well, so 2029?
2029. Oh, my God.
Unfortunately.
Well, hopefully earlier than that, but we will see.
Yeah, you see the penetration of the drug is not everybody starting tomorrow to treat a million of
last
patients.
Question, So last comment from Dr.
So Pinsky. The drug in the U.S. is being marketed. It's going to cost about $8,000 a year for the drug, I believe, for on a yearly basis. So it goes back to the question I asked when we started was, could you do the same effect with judicious use of diuretics and reduction in volume, or is this something, or is that... is that tubulogamellar feedback that's really having the bigger impact?
We really do not have really good data on diuretics. Some people did meta-analysis, we're looking at the data, and we cannot really draw some conclusion. Yeah, sympathetic nerve activity is activated if you inject furosemide. So a number of other effects are coming, and in the moment, the data from Dick Journey in Circulation and some others, they believe into tubulogamellar feedback also. So I think we think this is the mechanism.
And I thank all the speakers for their outstanding, intriguing talks. And I think we have 1 hour for lunch, and then we will continue with the debate about eating, which is always good.